Good morning. This is Tracy, right on Four Corners on KSJE 90.9 FM. This morning on Right on Four Corners, an encore presentation of an interview with Nate Powell, the graphic artist for March, the One Book, One Community read for 2018-2019. In the studio, you'll not only hear Nate, but Scott Micklin and Daniel Sullivan. We start the interview with me asking Nate who authored the text of March.
Andrew Iden essentially wrote the script, and then he and Congressman Lewis, you know, developed the story and the structure, you know, out of the historical and the subjective information from Congressman Lewis's experiences. But strictly speaking, Andrew wrote the script after that first process of writing, and then I took the script and flew with it and, you know, became the artist for the trilogy.
And what a good job you've done.
Well, thank you.
So how was it working
the honor of a lifetime
collaboratively with two other guys?
Oh, well, it's, I've worked with teams of two writers before. And so in general, like in a general sense, that's something I was acclimated to. I guess at that level, it simply involves working together for long enough to develop a strong sense of what your particular narrative interests are, what your points of focus are, and kind of developing a means by which you can write and draw for each other. So throughout doing the trilogy, the first book of March was more or less a document of the three of us learning to work together as storytellers. And then from our perspective, March Book 2 sort of takes a leap in terms of our teamwork and our narrative sensibilities, because we had finally kind of figured out some of those issues and kinks, and we're able to kind of work more smoothly on a creative level, but it also opened up more room for us to do to dig deeper with reference, with research, with making use of new information that was available to all of us.
That's very interesting. And they're seamless, too. You can't see the transition from the reader's point of view.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, works really well.
Let me chime in and ask you, Mr. Powell, and the reaction that you've gotten to the book that you've been involved with, and when it's been published, of course, what types of reactions are you getting from readers? I would imagine this book is targeted at a different type of reader than maybe would normally be reading about this subject.
Yeah, it depends. I guess before the first book was published, I was very much approaching the work much like I have approached any of my other projects and graphic novels over the years. And I didn't I sort of intentionally tried to avoid anticipating the potential readership or the context in which people would be reading. But I sort of had to reevaluate that entire relationship as soon as the first book was available, beginning to have personal, you know, face-to-face interactions with teachers who had brought their entire class to a signing, family members who had brought their entire family unit, parents who had brought their kids to get to meet Congressman Lewis, people who were involved with the movement, who had spent time in jail or on buses with Congressman Lewis. Very quickly, I realized that I personally was entering a project very unlike anything with which I had ever been involved before. So the responses have been very personal, very powerful. We prefer to discuss March as basically a roadmap to change, not just outlining the successes, but also the failures and the criticisms of such a massive, sweeping social movement. But by thinking of it as a roadmap, that's the only way to be able to take it forward and make something new out of this history and out of this collective experience. So, I don't know, it's as personal as, you know, it's very much as personal as it is political. It's as much memoir as history, and it's as much fine art as it is, you know, storytelling. It covers a lot of expanses, but being able to kind of activate the personal experiences of folks involved and sort of give new light and new voice to a lot of experiences which have sort of either been swept under the rug or have been buried through the path of time, the path of history, has been really rewarding and really necessary.
And I think a lot of folks think that, you know, since we went through all this in the 1960s, that things have improved for the better. And recently, it seems in some places in our country that we're devolving a little bit instead of evolving. That may be more of a political statement, but I don't mind making it. Would you agree with that, Mr. Powell, or what are your thoughts on current state of affairs?
Oh, yes. I mean, generally speaking, you are very much correct. I think the larger issue, the more specific issue, is that being a part of Generation X and having Southerner baby boomer parents learning about the history of the civil rights movement and the history that sort of surrounded me on a geographic and cultural level, but learning that from a generation of kind of white middle-class Southerners in the 1980s, it wasn't until my work on March that not only I was able to reopen up some of those lines of conversation and my parents were able to kind of reckon with the rest of their legacy as young people in Mississippi in the 50s and 60s, but it sort of provided for a window of reflection and analysis to see that the version of civil rights history that I learned in the 80s was very much a narrative of convenience. The Southern Poverty Law Center identifies this as the nine-word problem, which is that most American kids graduate from high school only knowing nine words about the civil rights movement, which is Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream. And it's very difficult even learning a basic working history as a young person, but not seeing how those dots are supposed to connect to each other, or being taught basic civil rights history as a kid in Alabama in the 80s, and, you know, hearing history always punctuated by this sort of dismissal or exception that it was a very different time. It was almost severed from the continuity that we share historically and culturally. It sort of defangs our collective understanding of the struggles necessary, the gains and the risks from the civil rights movement. And I think that now is one of those times in which the chickens have come home to roost, particularly for my generation and for the baby boomers, where the sort of failures of keeping that history alive and revealing it in all of its complexity has opened our society up to some very big pitfalls involving assumptions of progress, assumptions of safety, assumptions of security. And I think this is something that we're going to have to stress. You know, like, progress is something that doesn't just happen once. You know, society making progress is something that requires remaining vigilant about and ensuring that any social progress can be maintained.
Daniel Sullivan, let me ask you about the One Book, One Community program, because that is what this is all about, is to bring books like this into the classrooms, not just here at the college, but in high schools and elsewhere in the county, right, to talk about these issues that these books represent.
Right. So that's the underlying premise or overarching premise even of One Book, One Community, is to bring people together to discuss issues. But yes, we will have several thousand kids reading this book. So in both of the Farmington High Schools, Rocinante as well, and then the Gear Up New Mexico higher education program has adopted March as well. So the better part of Northern New Mexico will have March in its schools in some fashion or another, large scale or perhaps small.
And when we talk about the civil rights movement, there's so many jumping off points to have other conversations and relate it to current events and relate it to history and relate it to minority groups and all. I mean, all these things are popping into my brain.
Well, absolutely. And one of the things that Nate mentioned was the failure to acknowledge the past and where and how that's gotten us to where we are. And one of the events that we're running is in 1974, there were riots here in Farmington, and many people don't talk about that and don't acknowledge that. And we were able to obtain archive photos, and we will be doing a display of that. And Farmington was the subject of a civil rights investigation.
That's right.
And that wasn't actually, that didn't play a factor in us choosing the book. Once I chose the book, I learned about this. And that just illustrates what Nate's talking about, how we hide some of these problems. And I've certainly been asked that, to be honest. People have said, why are you dredging this up? I think it's dangerous not to.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I agree. I think that this, I learned so much, and I was a teenager during this era, but through the book, I learned so much more of what was going on during that time. It brought me much more sympathy and made me more aware of what's going on today.
I agree. I think, learning and relearning the material and sort of sitting at the drawing table, especially between 2012 and 2016, it was inspiring, it was also alarming,
right.
But it was fascinating in real time to be able to observe and draw parallels between the world of, 1963, 64, 65, and the world of, 2014, 2015, 2016 in real time as we were working on the trilogy. So as the trilogy progressed, it became a more regular bit of our creative process and our editorial process to kind of have some powwows with ourselves to continually reassess where the narrative of March was in relation to the world around us and be mindful of the question, should we explicitly draw any connections to the world of today within the pages of March? And ultimately what we came back to time and time again is that if we do the job correctly, the reader will be able to make those connections themselves. Our job is to tell the story, to make it plain, to make it unconcealed, and give people the opportunity to make those connections. And ultimately, those connections were kind of unavoidable.
So, Nate, when I read the trilogy, one of the things that I noticed is I felt like the books got progressively darker as they went along.
Certainly.
And yet it was juxtaposed in this framing device of the Obama inauguration. And so to me, that seemed to suggest hope. And I'm curious, A, if that was your intent, and B, would you perceive that differently now than you were when you were writing that, 6 years ago?
In one way, of course, it's very natural that I do perceive it in a slightly different way now than I did. However, I think the important takeaway that I can contribute to this as an answer to that question is that as I was entering the role of artist on March, I could see this framing device establishing itself by sort of bookending and framing the events of the civil rights movement through John Lewis's eyes by the 2009 inauguration of Barack Obama. Regardless of the fact that Congressman Lewis and Andrew and I are on the same political page, there was a part of me that was a little wary of what the intention, but what the perceived intention would be of that framing device. That, however, made me a little bit blind. And so that being, I guess, just coming from middle-class white America, made me blind to Congressman Lewis's subjective experience physically being at the 2009 inauguration. And once it took Andrew and the congressman to kind of lay out that the intention behind this, the framing device, was to convey the power of what John Lewis calls the spirit of history at work. And sometimes when I'm hanging out with Congressman Lewis, he has a really fantastic way of, an almost transcendent way of being able to reflect on and dwell in different time periods and sort of contextualize them in his mind and in his heart with what's happening today. And there are moments where sometimes he feels like he's living in the past as much as the present. And he feels those echoes kind of concurrently and on top of each other. So as the artist, my job was visually to sort of show that the physical space of the National Mall, going from you know, going from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial across the reflecting pool, past the Washington Monument, ultimately to the back steps of the U.S. Capitol, allowed John Lewis on that day to sort of see his own path as a young person in the civil rights movement, carry him through these physical locations, physically to the steps of the Capitol for the inauguration of the first African-American president. And it's something that I feel like I didn't have a chance to really make it click until halfway through the second book, when we began the campaign for the March on Washington in 1963. I realized that was the prime visual responsibility for that framing device, was to actually convey John Lewis's sense of the spirit of history at work in a tangible way on the side of the National Mall. And it allowed me to kind of see it in a very different and new way.
So it wasn't just about the inauguration or Obama, but about place and time as well. So that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, and that's sort of that's the middle ground, I think, as a narrative that March occupies. It fully functions as a document of history, but at the same time, it is the subjective experience of one person, more or less. And so there's sort of you're trying to sort of balance these two perspectives. You're making things accurate, responsible, truthful, and historical, but at the same time, we are seeing things through John Lewis's eyes and hearing them in his words. And so there's a degree of being beholden to his perspective and being able to illuminate that while not sacrificing, you know, responsible, accurate, historical storytelling.
Nate, a little bit of history with the One Book Project. The committee resisted for many years bringing in a graphic novel. There was always the perception, right, there was the perception that it was a comic book, not a serious work of art or literature. And we've turned the corner there. And what is your history with working with graphic novels?
Okay, well, I've been reading comics since I was 3, and I started drawing comics right when I turned 12, started self-publishing them just on a photocopier when I was 14, and just kind of sold them at the one comic book store in town and sold them out of my backpack at school. And I really never turned back from then. So that would have been pre-internet, early 90s Arkansas. So it took a while to develop a real awareness that comic book narratives could exist outside of superhero stories.
Right.
So there was a kind of a major shift in the mid to late 90s for me, where I realized that the storytelling possibilities were limitless within comics. That it's a medium as well as a language, but it's not a genre of storytelling. So I've been, I don't know, I guess since about 1998 or 99, I've just kind of been doing my thing, mostly making bizarre, subjectively powerful fiction accounts of people's experiences, but also working with other writers to tell fiction and nonfiction comics. I guess on that note, okay, it's fantastic that March has been able to play a role in the discussion of, you know, the long-awaited legitimizing, the continual argument for legitimizing graphic novels. But I think that a lot of that for the last 30 years or so has always come at the price. It's like a zero-sum game with mainstream comics. People feel like in order for graphic novels or in order for, quote, serious comics to be legitimate, people have to declare that comics have matured and that they're not just superheroes anymore.
Right.
So I feel like it's important for me to point out that 1970s and 80s X-Men comics actually gave me a social conscience in the first place, and I'm far from alone there. I feel like as an 11, 12, 13-year-old, being able to understand things in my own world like racism, sexism, homophobia, xenophobia, nationalism, through the context of this, you know, fictional superpowered conduit, allowed me to see my world through a new lens and a new set of criticisms, and allowed me to kind of react to it and clarify the world I wanted to see as a young person. And I owe all of that to superhero comics. I don't particularly see them as being that divorced from each other. So I feel like there is room for all of that to balance. I'm glad that we have graduated past the point of having to argue about that continuously. But at the same time, it's important to recognize that superhero comics have changed people's lives over and over again for decades at the same time.
And I'm with you. I think I grew up in a different place, but right about the same time you did, Nate. And I'm a big mm-hmm. fan of superheroes. They were my childhood companions. Actually, I lived with them in my head probably more than I did with real people at times.
You bet.
And we are planning, not this semester, but we'll be using the March series all year, a lecture on the social justice of superheroes, because I definitely feel like they have a very high moral barometer, and I find it fascinating. So
certainly
worthy of taking seriously, definitely.
Danielle, was there any pushback for selecting this book this year from the committee? I mean, again, I guess congratulations for breaking the ceiling on graphic novels.
Well, no, I mean, for us, the opposite.
Right.
We were targeting graphic novels.
Okay.
Or memoir. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a memoir in that case. But we wanted something different. We wanted something fun and interesting. And I'm not suggesting that the content is fun, but it is very accessible to
sure.
our students. And the other thing that we really liked was allowed for all different ages. So we have sixth graders through college students using this book, and there aren't many opportunities where you can find a book that would work, and this one does.
Right, which is all part of the One Book, One Community selection process, I think, is to think about the various ways that the book can be used in the classroom and out of the classroom. Tracy Hales-Vass, times have changed.
Times have changed.
With graphic novels.
Yes.
Right?
Right. As a former literature teacher, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I was really pleased to, dip my feet into March and learn about how the graphic novel memoir can be used. When you explain how so much of the structure of the art reflects on the story itself, so it adds a certain depth to the story.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, this is where, in terms of being a medium, comics, the visual storytelling in comics is inextractable from the text component. My parents were born in the mid-40s, and they've always been fairly comics literate. They grew up on comics, too. Thanks to having a cartoonist son, they have become more comics literate. But
of course,
through my experience with them, I feel like it was interesting to watch their awareness of some of the nonverbal and some of the less explicit modes of communication and information sharing within the comics page, to watch their awareness of those things emerge. It's very, it's a strange position that March Book One is for many people the first graphic novel they've ever read. One, criticism that I hear from time to time anonymously on the internet is that, when people are used to reading a book in terms of text existing in and of itself, people will feel that there might only be 10 or 15 pages worth of single space text within a 120 page graphic novel like March Book One. But it is the visual information, the narrative information, the flow of time, the ability to relate panels and pages back and forth to each other simultaneously to recontextualize the narrative. These are strengths that are unique to comics, and there is a wealth of information which is communicated not just non-verbally, but sometimes without the conscious awareness of the reader within the pages of a comic. It's something that really is utterly incomparable to other media, including film, because you have such a straight linear relationship to watching a movie or watching something on TV. So it's just something that kind of takes increasing awareness of and acclimation to.
What other works have you produced?
Let's see. My first full-length graphic novel was called Swallow Me Whole. It came out 10 years ago, and it was about these teenage step-siblings in the South with emerging symptoms of different mental disorders. A lot of it was their relationship to each other, they're coming of age in relationship to their environment and their community. But also, it's just a really trippy, frightening story at times.
It is.
Danielle, you're nodding. Yeah, I'm familiar with that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a trip.
And I did a book called Any Empire that came out 7 years ago that is fiction, but is mostly about my experiences as a G.I. Joe kid in a military family in the Reagan era. And it's about the relationship between violence and imagination. And in some ways, earlier versions of that book were prophetic in terms of outlining the world we live in now. But it's basically, the book is a series of questions about learning to develop awareness of the structures around you, learning to ask questions about them, and then basically empowering yourself as you grow to be able to push back against those. And then my newest book just came out. It's called Come Again, and that takes place in the late 70s in a dried-up hippie town in the Ozarks in Arkansas. And it's a horror story with a demon and a curse, but a lot of it is questions about changing ideals and how those relate to your life. It's about the horror of casualness in the face of an obvious crisis and how to deal with issues that people aren't taking with a certain level of urgency.
So are you doing the writing on those as well as the art?
Yes, I sure am. Generally, I've been a full-time cartoonist for about 9 years, and the way in which I've been able to make ends meet is by balancing writing and drawing my own graphic novels with simultaneous work with other writers on their projects. So I've done adaptations for Rick Riordan, for one of his Percy Jackson and the Olympians spinoffs. Uh-huh. I've worked before March. I did another mostly nonfiction work that was set against a backdrop of a forgotten chapter of civil rights movement history called The Silence of Our Friends. And that sort of served as a boot camp for March.
Are you working on something new now?
Yes, right. I have one more project that was kind of backed up from my days doing March. Mm-hmm. that I'm finishing up in the next year. It's called Two Dead, and it takes place in the 1940s in my hometown of Little Rock, Arkansas. It's written by this friend of mine, Van Jensen, who does a number of things. He's written comics, and he's worked on Stranger Things, and now he publishes an arts magazine out of Atlanta. But it's basically a hard-boiled detective story that's really about post-World War II unspoken PTSD and the trauma of war, the trauma of a society immediately after World War II that is going through a buckling, a social regression back into racial and sexual inequality, and sort of presaging the labor and housing crises that happened in 1947, which are kind of underreported. But mostly it's about, you know, the monsters that develop from unspoken trauma and unspoken pain, but under the guise of a hard-boiled detective story.
Well, you handle the lightweight stuff, don't you?
Yes. Just a tad of fun.
Right.
Indeed.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to having Nate on campus. And not only will he be on campus, he'll be doing a book signing,
right,
and delivering a talk, but then the next day he's going into the high schools as well to deliver a talk. So he's going to reach a good part of Farmington, New Mexico in that short visit that he's here.
And that is scheduled for October 23rd.
Yes.
Right?
High schools are October 24th.
Very good.
I'm excited that everybody's going to be reading this and will be opened up to the graphic novel. And we look forward to your next book when it comes out too. Back to the collaborative effort. How much contact did you actually have with John Lewis?
Oh, this is another way in which March was utterly unlike any other project I've worked on. When I'm collaborating with someone, I am constantly in contact with them. But basically, over the course of doing March for 4.5 or 5 years, every weekend, at least once a week, 6 months a year, for years, we were all on the road together, speaking, doing signings, traveling. And while we were physically traveling together, we tried to get as much work done as we could, whether that had to do with showing pages in progress, clarifying details, sort of revisiting memories from the firsthand experience, Andrew and Congressman Lewis worked together in Congressman Lewis's congressional office. They didn't work on March during work hours for obvious ethical reasons. So they had to put in a lot of late nights and weekends. During the work weeks while I was working on pages actively, I would be speaking to Andrew, and Andrew would have to run some things by the congressman. But I was very fortunate in that I'd be able to get 5 or 10 pages done and then travel and meet with the whole gang somewhere across America and be able to sort of, work with and adapt and refine things in person on the spot. It very much made March a living, breathing thing. And it allowed us in real time to kind of see where our narrative strengths and shortcomings were so that we could adapt to that.
That was an interview with Nate Powell, graphic artist of March, the One Book, One Community selection. Remember, Nate will be appearing in person on San Juan College's campus next week, October 23rd. This is Tracy Hales Vass, right on Four Corners on KSJE 90.9 FM, Farmington, New Mexico.